They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
So Wall Street reforms have been on the books now for 6 months.
How have things changed?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. It's the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Thursday, February 17th.
Coming up, the financial reform law gets its first real test. Also, international monitors say Afghanistan's largest bank should be under new management. And what do Oreos, Lil Wayne, and Marketplace have in common? You're going to find out.
We're all going to find out later. But first, the Senate Banking Committee is going to be a pretty busy place today on Capitol Hill. Members will be grilling federal regulators who are set to talk today about progress in the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act. It passed last summer, as you'll recall. Marketplace New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
The Dodd-Frank Act set out to reform our entire financial system in just 2 years. So how's that going?
They're up to their eyeballs in alligators because there is a whole lot of work to do.
That's Lawrence Lease, a partner at law firm Duane Morris. He says so far, the Securities and Exchange Commission has written new rules to make executive pay more transparent. But it has roughly 70 other deadlines to meet in the next 11 months. Kevin Petrasek, a partner at law firm Paul Hastings, says the law's biggest challenge is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which doesn't even have a boss.
There are numerous observers wondering what's taking so long.
Petrasek says the watchdog consumer agency is the linchpin of financial reform. How it decides to set rules for mortgages and credit cards will influence every other regulator. Dodd-Frank requires 11 agencies to make 243 new rules. As for the law's mission of preventing banks from being too big to fail, it's too early to tell. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com/marketplace.
Well, many Republicans aren't very happy about the new law, and the GOP is expected to criticize it. Some would like to delay and defund it. Diane Swonk is chief economist with Mesirow Financial, and she's with us from Chicago. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
So first of all, tell us what's at stake today. I mean, is there really a chance that eventually Dodd-Frank would get defunded?
Well, the issue about Dodd-Frank was more about what it didn't say than what it did say. It left much of the decisions up to the regulators themselves, which are continuing to try to figure out how they're actually going to implement the law. So defunding it isn't going to make much of a difference since the regulators already have it in their hands and have been trying to figure out what exactly it means to implement it.
All right, but the industry has been complaining pretty loudly about how this law is already starting to impact them, particularly this new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Is there anything to those complaints?
You know, that's the one part of the law where there was a lot of details, and a lot of it was passed, actually, the consumer protection laws before Dodd-Frank was passed, and it will, in fact, be careful what you wish for. We wanted more supervision of consumer lending for obvious reasons after the housing bust, and now consumer credit is harder to get, more expensive, and less profitable for many financial services firms. So, of course, that's where you're going to hear the screaming the loudest. So I guess this is one of those things, be careful what you wish for, because we've got it now.
Diane, finally, let me just ask you, I mean, put this in context for us. This is, we're 6 months after this law was passed. We're just 2 years after the financial crisis. Does it surprise you that we're talking about already defunding the law that was supposed to help us protect against a future crisis?
You know, what's interesting is how little actually the law did. Many people didn't want to pass a lot of regulations initially because they thought it would overregulate. And aside from the consumer protection laws, it actually is very loosely defined, and the overregulation stuff is not as much in there. What is the problem today is the uncertainty because the regulators have not decided how to execute on the law. That is costing financial firms a lot of money, but I'm not sure there's a lot of sympathy for that among voters.
Diane Swonk, chief economist at Mesirow Financial, thanks so much.
Thank you.
As we mentioned, the banking committee is going to be busy. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner also goes before the committee today to talk about the president's 2012 budget proposal. Maybe politicians would do a bit better to leave the budget up to more average folk, Jeremy. Have you heard about this?
No.
When presented, there's this new study. When presented with the budget in some detail, most respondents of a University of Maryland study were able to reduce the deficit. They even came up with solutions to the Social Security mess.
Huh.
So researcher Stephen Call heads up Maryland's program for public consultation, and he's with us now. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
You asked everyday people to solve the budget deficit, which isn't an easy task. What did you find?
It was really quite extraordinary. We presented a representative sample of Americans, about 800 Americans, the federal budget broken down into 31 areas and said, you can increase or decrease it as you see fit. And they were able to substantially cut the spending levels by about $146 billion. We also went through revenues, income taxes, corporate taxes, and they did actually increase revenues by, on average, $292 billion. So they did make a substantial dent in the budget deficit.
Give us some specifics. You mentioned some taxes went up and a lot of spending went down. What kind of solutions did people come up with?
Well, the biggest cut that they made was to defense spending, which they cut just over $100 billion. They also cut intelligence, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. They cut federal highways. They cut the space program. They cut veterans benefits. Those were the biggest areas of cuts. They actually increased a few areas, too, job training, the environment, education.
What about politics? Any deference toward politics in this?
It's not really what you'd expect. The independents did the best, and they made the biggest cuts and made the biggest increases. That was followed by the Democrats, and the Republicans had the least cuts in spending and the least increases in taxes.
If people like you and I can handle the problem, why is it so tough for people in Washington to do this, to make this work?
Within Washington, there's such a battle between all these forces. But if you give the average American just the time to just sit down and say, okay, look, here is the problem. People can think in a holistic way, and they don't just think in terms of their own interests. They really were thinking about what's really necessary for the country as a whole.
Stephen Call, director of the Program for Public Consultation at the University of Maryland. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And there's a link to the study, by the way, at marketplace.org.
Well, President Obama flies to the Bay Area today to talk about job growth with leaders from one sector of the economy that's actually doing pretty well, high tech. Let's get the details now from our Silicon Valley correspondent, Steve Henn. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
So tell us who the president's going to be meeting with.
Well, Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, Eric Schmidt, Google CEO, and Steve Jobs from Apple.
Steve, I thought Steve Jobs was out on medical leave.
He is, but he's been seen around town eating at Indian restaurants in Mountain View and recently on campus, so he's expected to be there tonight.
Now, President Obama has been asking a lot of CEOs all across the country to do more hiring. Is that the message he's going to be bringing to Silicon Valley, which is already doing pretty well, right?
Yeah, I think he will probably be asking these CEOs what the government can do to spur innovation. You know, he might be trying to get their secret sauce. Google and Apple and Facebook have been doing tremendously well, generating a huge amount of wealth and profits and products people like. But the dirty little secret here is that these companies actually don't create that many jobs. Google has less than 30,000 employees. Apple has 30,000 employees. Facebook, just a few thousand total. Meanwhile, Apple's biggest contractor in China, Foxconn, has more than a million people working there. So these companies are creating wealth, not jobs, here. And in Santa Clara County, the headquarters of all three firms, the unemployment rate is still above 10%.
Wow. Marketplace's Steve Henn in Silicon Valley. Thanks, Steve.
Sure thing.
Commercial broadcaster CBS said advertising sales were up 12% in its latest quarter, and that helped the Tiffany Network to make a little money in the last 3 months. Honda says it's recalling more than 700,000 cars, including 09 and 10 model Fits in the United States. Faulty motion springs could cause the engine to stall.
Some economic reports out today. Consumer prices in this country rose by nearly 0.5% in January, attributed to big hikes in food and energy costs, in other words, gasoline. Also, the government reported first-time jobless claims jumped last week to 410,000. That's after a big drop the week before. One more number, Hawaii tourism. It's up 10% last month.
Ah.
And by the way, Steve, the temperature today in Waikiki Beach.
I don't want to hear this.
81 degrees.
Mm.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, February 17th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You can follow me on Twitter at Radio Chio.
I'm on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson, and I am Jeremy Hobson in New York. Now let's get to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world?
Well, the United States today is expected to put more pressure on Bahrain's government to use restraint in efforts to tamp down protests there. In violent unrest already, three protesters were killed today. Hundreds were injured. Bahrain, though, is actually a pretty wealthy place. The BBC's Katie Watson is with us now from Dubai. She's the Middle East correspondent there. Good morning, Katie.
Morning, Steve.
So if Bahrain is doing well financially, what's causing this discontent there?
Well, Bahrain's no stranger to political volatility, and that's mainly because of religious differences. Bahrain's rulers have encouraged a lot of foreign workers into the country too, not just from the Gulf, but expats from around the world. And that's helped Bahrain become a major hub for finance, for shipping, oil refining. But it's also left the local population competing for jobs with immigrant workers who've driven wages down.
And so as a hub then, Katie, are the protests disrupting business the way the unrest did in Egypt?
Well, at the moment, there's not much in effect, thankfully. Unlike most of its neighbouring states, Bahrain's relatively small oil producers, but it does have some major oil refineries. So far, all the banks and the stock market have also remained open. And fund managers say they are keeping a close eye on the situation, so that's still being watched.
And Katie, how is this important to the United States?
Bahrain is home to the US Navy's 5th Fleet. That helps protect oil tankers passing up through the Gulf to the Suez Canal. So the US does have an interest in obviously keeping a close eye on it. Protests are escalating, and now the military's taken control of the capital. So who knows how this will turn out.
All right, the BBC's Katie Watson in Dubai. Katie, thank you.
You're welcome.
Today, Qantas put a price tag on its super jumbo engine problems. $80 million. A few months back, you'll remember, a Qantas flight was forced to make an emergency landing after one of its Rolls-Royce engines exploded in midair. The airline then grounded its entire fleet of Airbus A380s because of the incident. Reporter Christopher Worth has more.
Today's announcement is the first time Qantas has pinned a number to the losses it suffered from halting operations on its super jumbo planes. The problem took over 3 weeks to solve and disrupted travel plans for thousands of passengers, which is why $80 million doesn't sound like much. Howard Wieldon of BGC Partners says that although it seemed to drag on at the time, engineers at Rolls-Royce actually acted rather quickly.
Rolls-Royce solved the problem. So I think overall, I'm not surprised that this figure is lower than some might have thought.
That said, Rolls-Royce didn't walk away scot-free. Fixing the faulty engines cost the company $90 million, but Wieldon says confidence in the engine maker has returned. And while there was some speculation the incident could hurt Airbus, the maker of the A380, he says although there has been some small delay in delivering new aircraft, it's done no long-term damage to the company's major investment in the super jumbo jet. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
In Afghanistan, the International Monetary Fund just completed a big look at the economy there over a week of sifting through a bunch of books. And the IMF says management of the country's largest private bank, Kabul Bank, should be taken over by someone, anyone. Corruption and mismanagement have cost Kabul Bank hundreds of millions of dollars. The BBC's Quentin Somerville joins us now from Kabul with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
Remind us exactly what happened at this bank. Where did this money go?
Well, this isn't any ordinary bank. If you can imagine a bank that pretty much pays everybody's salary in the country, Kabul Bank pays the salaries of policemen, of teachers, and it also had the president's brother on the board, Mahmoud Karzai. So it was a very well-connected bank, but it turned out that it had huge loans, many of those loans given with very uncertain terms, no payback date, and that's what caused the bank to almost collapse, and the central bank in Afghanistan had to step in and effectively bail the bank out.
And how have authorities responded there, Quentin?
They've gone through the books with a fine-tooth comb. There have been a number of investigations. In fact, the US Treasury Department's involved in one of them. And they've discovered that almost like $600 million worth of loans are outstanding. And what they've been doing is very carefully going through and making sure that they can renegotiate those loans and get the people who borrowed the money to pay it back.
Now you say, Quentin, this is the country's biggest bank. How important is it that this is going on?
One of the things that President Karzai's government is always criticized for is corruption. And this doesn't help him in any way. Clearly, this bank was being used as a kind of treasure chest by the great and the good here in Afghanistan.
The BBC's Quentin Somerville in Kabul. Quentin, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, we told you about the ongoing chatter about the federal budget. Of course, the list of what did make it into President Obama's proposal is a long one, but there's still plenty of stuff that didn't make it in. One item, Steve, involves the Panama Canal, albeit indirectly.
Okay.
Engineers are trying to make the canal bigger. They're supposed to finish by, I think, 2014, so that larger ships will be able to pass through. Well, to handle those ships, the Port of Miami was hoping the federal government would pay to deepen Miami's shipping channel. But as Marina Giovanelli reports now from Miami, officials will have to look elsewhere for the money.
The Port of Miami wants to deepen its shipping channel by 8 feet so it can accommodate ships known as Super Post Panamax.
These ships are larger. They bring more cargo. So basically almost twice as large as what we can accommodate right now.
Deputy Port Director Juan Carrilla says Miami is one of only three ports on the East Coast that could accommodate the bigger ships. The port in New Jersey has a low-hanging bridge that would block the ships. The port in Norfolk, Virginia needs to make way for Navy vessels. Carrilla says if the Eastern Seaboard wants to be a player in international shipping, Miami is where it's at. So he couldn't believe it when his colleague came to tell him they didn't get the federal money to dig.
I asked him to go back and check again. I'll tell you why, because this project, we were not asking for a lot of money.
The port had asked the president for just $100,000 out of the $150 million it would cost to dredge. Carrilla's team is now looking to Congress and the Department of Transportation for the funds. From Miami, I'm Marina Giovanelli for Marketplace.
Former President Bill Clinton's two terms took up much of the dot-com boom, right? He was there between, what, 93 and 2001.
Yep.
But the former president, Jeremy, this week told this tech conference in New York that of all the time that he was there in the White House, he only sent two emails. Two emails in the 8 years he was there. I know.
Just two.
This is odd. One to American troops stationed in the Balkans,
yeah,
and the other to astronaut and former Ohio Senator John Glenn, who at the age of 77 was on a mission to outer space. I remember that. That was
well, maybe if you send one to outer space, that might count as, you know, 200 or something like that.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Maybe
is that like dog years? I don't know what
right,
that is.
Yeah.
So Mr. Clinton joked to the group that he wasn't worried if the Republican Congress subpoenaed those emails.
One good side of it.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to create and manage a high-quality website or blog. Visit Squarespace.com/marketplace and sign up for a free trial. Then choose a design and color scheme that's uniquely you. That's Squarespace.com/marketplace. We thank Squarespace for their support.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, February 17th in New York. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in L.A., I'm Steve Chiotakis.
Well, Steve, you know that lap band surgery that many people use to lose weight?
Oh, yeah.
Well, yesterday, the FDA approved the surgery for a whole lot more people who are not as heavy. The decision could have major financial implications for the company that makes the technology, California-based Allergan, and it could also have implications for healthcare costs. Let's bring in Marketplace's Eve Troe for more on this story. She's with us from Los Angeles. Good morning, Eve.
Hi, Jeremy.
So tell us about the financial implications here, Eve.
Well, they're pretty big, for Allergan especially. The new rules double the number of people who can get the lap band surgery to about 26 million. That means a lot more sales. Now, the band itself is this inflatable silicone ring that blocks off part of your stomach. And what Allergan asked the FDA to do, and it did, was lower the body mass index, or BMI, that patients need to qualify. BMI is a bit complicated, so you can think of it this way. Someone who's 5'6" and has diabetes used to have to weigh 216 pounds to get a lap band. Now they only have to weigh 186.
Wow, so a big change there. What are the implications, Eve, for the healthcare industry?
Well, some experts say that this tips the scale in favor of surgery to deal with obesity rather than medications. The lap band is only prescribed for people who've tried diets and exercise and drugs to lose weight. But some people say the FDA is actually driving people towards surgery with this move because it hasn't approved very many weight loss drugs.
Marketplace's Eve Troe in Los Angeles. Thanks, Eve.
Thanks.
Well, in some parts of Mexico, getting a work visa for the United States is a lot like winning the lottery. Unless, of course, that work visa is a fraud. From Monterrey, Mexico, Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has this report on a scam that's targeting poor migrant workers.
When he came to the United States, Jose Paz expected to work in construction. He says he and other migrants each paid Mexican recruiters $400 to get legal work in the U.S., but when he arrived, there were no jobs.
The recruiters falsified signatures for real companies so they could get the group into the country.
Paz was stranded in Colorado in the winter.
We stayed there without money. We didn't have clothes for the cold climate, so we suffered a lot.
He had to borrow money to get home. In the end, a trip intended to enrich him actually cost Jose Paz about $1,800. Luciano Escamilla investigates fraud for the U.S. consulate in Monterrey. He says immigrant workers are easy targets because they're desperate for work.
The people want to hear good news. And the swindlers, they know what to say to these guys to get money.
Poor folks scrape together everything they can, only to lose it.
We have heard everything from $100 to $5,000. People who sell their houses to get the money to travel to the U.S. And at the end, they got nothing.
As a rule of thumb, the U.S. consulate's Mark Ludicky recommends,
if someone is asking you to pay any fees up front, then in all likelihood, that opportunity does not exist.
Visa fraud attracts hustlers on both sides of the border. Luke Durkin is the consulate's fraud prevention manager.
Employers in the United States will request more workers than they actually need. They will charge workers for those visas. Other times, people will submit entirely false petitions where they're charging workers for the visas.
The Migrants Attention Center in Monterrey helps workers avoid getting ripped off. It estimates that poor Mexican workers have invested more than $2 million in U.S. jobs that don't exist. In Monterrey, Mexico, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
And finally, Steve, you may have heard earlier this week, the cookie maker Oreo asked its 16.5 million Facebook fans to like one of its Facebook posts so it could win a Guinness World Record.
I think you mentioned it, as a matter of fact. Yeah.
I did. Yeah. The other day, I saw that on the web, and I thought, oh, maybe we should talk about this. It would be the most Facebook post likes in a 24-hour period, and the previous number was something like, I don't know, 40,000.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Oreo did succeed in beating the record. It got 114,000 likes in one day. Pretty good, seems
okay.
like.
Yeah, nice.
Okay, but then rapper Lil Wayne. Heard about
That's
the
L-I-L.
Oreos.
Lil Wayne.
L-I-L,
That's right.
Right.
That's
yeah.
right.
Lil Wayne heard about the Oreo stunt, and he asked his 20 million Lil fans to like his Facebook posting.
Yeah.
And he beat Oreo five times
over. Five times over? Wow.
Five times over. So now Marketplace Midday Update podcast listeners, this is your chance. You go online, go to Facebook. Find APM Marketplace.
It's APM Marketplace, yeah.
APM Marketplace. Okay, first you like us, and then go and like the post that we have put up there to beat Lil Wayne. But you've got to do it fast because you only have 24 hours.
All right, wait. So are you saying, so to beat Lil Wayne, we've got
to get 550,000 or something. Yeah. We can do it. But
I feel like we're on a
really
pledge drive. Just one more call.
One more like. Okay, this one's free. Okay. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great Thursday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.